Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and everything going on in our interconnected world, in our food, water, air, and earth, in our community, in our society, in our global biosphere and ecology here on planet Earth. And each week we talk with people who are experts, thought leaders, activists, environmentalists, who can reveal different facets of our interconnected and complex and increasingly, sadly, troubled world, which we are trying to heal and recover as we go. I am thrilled to have on today as our guest someone that I've long held in mind to appear on the show, and I'm so glad that she can be with us. My guest is a longtime friend, really, and colleague, Monica Perez Nevarez. She is a longtime environmentalist, an executive director at Basura Cero, Puerto Rico, a creator at Environmental Heroines Wiki Project, has had full exposure to our climate problems at Climate Reality, and also has dealt in project management, communications, and strategic planning. In other words, another terrific generalist with as many hands as some of the traditional Hindu goddesses have been depicted having, who is, you know, managing, stirring, healing, and bringing about recovery in all so many different kinds of ways, which we'll be discussing on the show today. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Monica Perez Nevarez.
Thank you, Allison. What a lovely introduction, my Lord. That's great.
Well, I know it fits you. You know, right now, the top item on your list is you, in the wake of the terrible environmental crisis that hit Puerto Rico, had moved, and in fact, I think you'd actually been thinking of doing that earlier, maybe had, but you were there in Puerto Rico helping in the recovery, deal with so many different issues that are there, and, you know, we look forward very much to hearing, what you're witnessing and what you're involved with and what the issues and situation is like on the ground in Puerto Rico. Please first orient us.
Yeah. Okay, let me correct you one little thing. I came back from New York. I was living in New York, but I came back to Puerto Rico in 2015. So I was here during Hurricane Maria. Let me tell you, I had been through hurricanes before, but nothing like this. And mm-hmm. I was living in a 10th floor apartment. And the night before the hurricane hit, I heard the governor say on TV that anything above, any apartment above a 5th floor should be evacuated immediately. I started calling friends, and I was very lucky to be taken in twice through Irma and through Maria, by my friends. Believe me, their house was very, very sturdily built, but it didn't matter because from 8 o'clock at night until 2 o'clock when it really, really went right over us, the winds were just I've never heard anything such like that before. And the next day when I woke up, I walked out a little bit. Every single tree, every single leaf had gone. The houses that were well built still stood, but all of the greenery everywhere that you could look had gone brown. The roads were incredibly impassable. It was just one tree after another after, and if it wasn't trees, it was electrical posts. So it was an amazing job that the people on the ground, the people in the communities, and some of the people in the government. You've got to realize nobody could get around. But slowly but surely, the people in their own places started clearing the roads, and then the government people were able to get into the places that most needed work. I think you all know that it took in some areas 9 or 10 months for them to get even electricity, And some areas in the mountains were cut off because their one way in was a bridge, and the bridge was gone. So I've got to tell you, this has been a terrible story of catastrophe, but an amazing story of help. We've had Chef Jose Andres came in and served 2 million meals on his own initiative, and then got flack for it because apparently after that he got a contract to do it, and you know, people in Puerto Rico, oh, he's not from here, well, only we should get it. So the things that go on here are amazing. Yeah. Mostly in the communities, you know, the people have helped themselves, and they are resigned to just live through whatever it is that they have to live through to get through to another day. And it shows an amazing amount of resilience. I'm heartbroken to say that a lot of people that were on the cusp of being, you know, either healthy or financially secure didn't make it. There's a lot of small businesses that closed their doors and will never open again. There's a lot of people coming in from the States and from Europe with much more money than we have that are buying up real estate at pennies for the dollar. Besides Maria, Puerto Rico had always had been in a terrible depression, economic depression. It wasn't a recession. We were in a depression 3 years before the Great Recession hit. So if you can imagine. And right in the middle of that, our government defaulted on some bonds that they had put out, because basically our economy for 3 years had just been downgrading, you know, becoming smaller and smaller, and In our world, we don't know how to plan for, you know, for slowing down or for downturns. We just know, oh, we fix everything with growth, which is a problem. And because of that, instead of stopping and tightening the belt, what the government did was offer more bonds at higher prices, and more people bought. And it came to the point where our government couldn't pay for them anymore. And so they had sent the Congress of the United States had sent a fiscal oversight board, which had at that point, right before Maria, they were already telling us that they were going to impose austerity measures, and then Maria hit, and then they imposed the austerity measures. So we were in a contracting economy. We had a humongous catastrophe, physical catastrophe in Maria, and then we had the economic follow-through, which was, no, we'll take every single last cent that you have to pay this debt. So it is a really tough situation here. The people that have jobs are the lucky ones, even though most of the jobs are the median job salary here is like $19,000, which is an embarrassment because the cost of living is somewhere between Orlando, Florida, and Boston, Massachusetts. So not cheap. We consume 93% of the stuff that we consume, mostly food, but everything else, cars, you know, the furniture, everything that we consume, 93% is brought from abroad in ships or in planes. So that adds, you know, a little, like 20% to all our costs.
Is that because you're an island and you can't truck anything in and has to all be brought in? So you're really coming, you know, it's like when it all works, it's all fine. And when it doesn't work, suddenly you find it out at a moment of crisis. That's concerning. That's terrible. What?
Yeah, there's really no way to recover from it economically. Once we start going down, it's just a downward spiral which we can't really control. And the thing that really scares me is that I'm going to say 450,000 households live in areas that are that will in fact be impacted by sea level rise, not just by big storms, but by sea level rise. And that's a huge amount of households, you know. Our city of San Juan, the Condado and the Isla Verde sections, which are all the tourist sections where all the big beaches and all the big hotels are, those are all in risk of sea level rise. So ironically, so is the main international airport, the smaller regional airport, and all of the ports are going to be underwater with sea level rise. And I'm talking just, you know, 1 or 2 meters, and they're useless. So we're an island. We get everything from outside, and all of a sudden we have, you know, everything that's quite at risk in the things that climate change are breaking. Not to mention that there's a small island. We consume an awful lot because we have a robust underground economy. But we used to have 119 landfills, of which only 29 are open. And of those 29, the EPA says that 19 of them are in noncompliance. They're leaching toxic material, just liquids, into our aquifers. So it's a really dire situation, particularly because they put every single down tree, instead of recycling them or giving them to local artisans to work. No. They put everything into the landfill. So, and let me tell you something. There's more people here in Puerto Rico that understand climate change and know about sustainability and are doing so much more than the government asks them to do. Because unlike in the United States, where there have been, you know, these decades-long campaign of denial or just delay, here people we also have much more influence from Europe and from South America, who are areas that really do embrace the science of climate change, and therefore, you know, are very much aware of everything that's going on. Our problem is that we are aware that it's going on, but we have no way of getting the resources to even begin to minimize or mitigate any of them at this point.
Because so that rather than there being relief, international relief, that is blocked, that is stalled. What is the economic dynamic? Is the date that anyone can turn to government and expect help, you know, kind of past its due date, and that's never going to happen, even though people would like it to or think it might?
Well, on the one hand, because of our political status, we are a territory of the United States, so we really can't get international aid because we are the U.S. And then we really don't get a lot. We do get some, but we don't get a lot of U.S. aid because, A, the philanthropic sector has been under great economic strain and gone much more regional than they used to be. And second, because everybody thinks, oh, well, let them fix it themselves. Well, here, the middle class has been eviscerated. Nobody has discretionary income to say, you know, donate money to. There's a plethora of NGOs, nonprofits down here, because the government has steadily been unable to not serve the public. With every time that they cut their budget, you know, another NGO or another nonprofit would crop up because the services were still needed. So we have a robust nonprofit sector, but not any of them have any kind of money. And we all rely on volunteers, which, you know, is an amazing, we have an amazing group of people here. But the volunteers usually work, so they're, you know, whenever they have time. And even with that, I just love them to death, because without them, we wouldn't be able to do anything at all. But still hard.
But even with them, you're kind of hard pressed. I mean, this is
it feels like
this is the result of privatization. This is the result of privatization. So anything we privatize, like, for example, you know, hey, in the U.S., the post office, you know, is basically, once you've privatized it, if it's a service that can't be profitable and there's no income, it basically, you know, it's at risk to go bye-bye completely and not be there, and all of the, you know, services that people need or rely on or have just been deconstructed and you know, are no longer, you know, being able to be supplied.
Right now, they're trying to privatize the electric company. The electric company was a government company, and it has had a lot of problems. They're not just from now. But they're now trying to privatize it, and I think that they're having a problem because, A, they're the price that they're trying to sell it at, and, B, the amount of debt that it has. And I feel for the people that work at PREPA. That's the acronym of the agency. Because they're really good people. I've spoken to them. And they do hard work under very hard conditions. Their problem is that PREPA was used to a higher level of consumption. And then after the 936 companies left because they weren't getting any more tax breaks, then they all left, and all of a sudden that was really hurtful economically for them. And then as they left, more people became unemployed, and they left. So another hit to their bottom line. So they've been going, you know, the electricity company has been losing their clientele now for about 10 years. And what they've got now is about 60% of what they used to have before before 2005 or 6. So it's quite a blow, you know. And I don't know how they are going to make it up. I you know, there's the people just aren't here.
Have a lot of people left? I mean, have a lot of people left, or who, you know, who is able to leave? Anybody can leave. I mean, so here we have another potential migration situation or an active migration situation. And is the U.S. welcoming them because, you know, you're considered part of the U.S.? Or, I mean, how is that going?
Well, first of all, we are all U.S. citizens. We were born, and since 1917, everybody born here is a U.S. citizen. So we can travel back and forth. I have my American passport. Everybody here is an American. We just happen to also speak Spanish. that's the only difference. A lot of people left. In fact, I'm going to say 150,000 at least after Maria. They had been leaving in dribs and drabs for 3 years before then, because of the just the sheer economics. Once you lose your job, there are no other jobs. You have to become an entrepreneur. And by the way, there are some incredible opportunities here for savvy entrepreneurs that can wait out 3 to 5 years of very little money until, you know, their business gets going, because the needs are all here. It's just that nobody has, you know, to be an entrepreneur, you have to have a home that you won't lose if you risk everything while trying to start a business, you know? This is why it's so important to me. I studied business administration and economics, and then I recently finished a sustainability management master's at Columbia. That married both of my interests, which were, you know, how do you run a successful business and how do you save the planet? You know, in the weekends I had always been a really avid environmental activist. And then during the week I worked at my consulting or at my jobs. I worked for 10 years for the Small Business Administration. It's a perfect, to me, a relevant marriage of interests at this point, particularly for Puerto Rico. And by the way, I was very happy in New York, but New York was just so expensive. And here, I have my family, and they were gracious enough to accept me in, so I can survive while I'm trying to be a little entrepreneurial. And on the other hand, work for Basura Cero, which in English would be zero waste. So it's an international movement of trying to lower the amount of waste that we produce. Very, very necessary here. because we're a very small island, 35 miles by 100 miles, that's nothing. To have that many landfills and that many of them closed that we can't use because, you know, that's it, they're done. Talk about not in my backyard.
Yeah, I mean, when you're on an island and you have a landfill, you know, it's not kind of able to go anywhere, is it? I mean, it's not like, okay, let's take this away, we're done.
Right.
I mean, it just
it
is there.
There's no away here. It's all here. You know? I think that for years we have been getting away with it because we put the landfills in places where, you know, they weren't very near people. And they did a good job of covering them, periodically with enough soil so that a little grass would grow and then put some more junk on top. And, you know, if you don't know that if you don't know that you are in a or passing by a landfill, you just think that it's a big mound. So.
And do you have any, do you have nuclear there? I mean, do you have to deal with nuclear hazardous waste and that kind of thing? Oh, that's a real blessing. Oh.
Thank God. But let me tell you, that is because a lot of local activists have worked very tirelessly to not even let the powers that be think of that. Because besides that, They also had a plan for a natural gas pipeline that would have dissected the island, and we fought tooth and nail to have that one taken away as well. And yet, now they're thinking of it again. So every single plan that the government has had up to now, none of them pass the sustainability test. None of them are sustainable. All of them, I would say, are trying to continue to do the things that they did before, the things that got us into this mess. They're just trying to get out of the problem by doing the same thing that got us into the problem.
And is it the government of the United States, the government of Puerto Rico? Like, which government at which level? Or what is the interaction between them?
I say at all levels. Here, the local government, think it's a governorship. We have a governor, and we vote for him. We can't vote for the president of the United States, but we can vote in primaries, which, you know, wouldn't go figure. So I think that it's emblematic that when our president came down here, the one visual that I have is of him throwing paper towels to the public, because that's all he thought was necessary. And I know that part of that is our fault, because our own governor had, you know, told him there was only 16 people dead, when in reality it ended up being more closer to 3,000 people. But who, by the way, who are still, you know, they're still not officially saying anything. We've just done some really good studies that prove that that's more or less the number, but we haven't actually gotten the actual number.
Oh my. And that's just because they're sitting on the information, because if the number came out, it would be embarrassing. Is it because they're not, no one's charged
with it? I would imagine that it is embarrassing. But the other thing is that I'm going to have to say that, in my opinion, it's because there's not enough people salaried jobs that can go ahead and do that kind of work. We are in such a chaotic mentality, a mentality of chaos, let me put it that way, of, you know, just putting out fires every single day. There's no time to breathe. There's just putting out fires. That's all there is.
And it's been that way ever since then, like day after day, the whole time.
Yeah, and believe me, and before then as well. I'd say that it was a critical condition since 2006, really.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Wow.
But You know, what gets me is that I've also, I mean, Maria hit other places. It hit Florida. It hit Houston. I mean, there's been the wildfires. The climate is really shouting at us, you know, this is going to happen, and it's going to happen whether you like it or not. And yet there are still people that can look at all these things that are happening, you know, the coral die-offs, the amount of marine animals that are dying and or already dead, the heat, oh my God, the heat. And they all say, no, that's normal. No, it isn't normal. We are so far away from normal, it's not even funny.
What is the actual range of weather that you have there, you know, seasonally, or, you know, what are the challenges that you're dealing with on that level?
Well, we have a dry season and we have a wet season, and we have a hot season and what used to be a really comfortable season, which was the winter season when we got all the fresh air. When you guys up in the continental U.S. were getting terrible snowstorms, we got the freshest breezes down here. You wouldn't believe. Then in summer, we're very lucky because as an island, we are constantly hit by the trade winds. So it does get hot. If you're standing in the sun, it'll get hot. But because of the trade winds, it makes it livable. And it can be cool. But believe me, I remember when I was a child growing up here, and it was a lot cooler. These last few years particularly have been really, really hot. In fact, it's been a hot winter as far as I'm concerned.
And what is a hot winter look like in terms of the actual weather?
It used to be 70 degrees, and now it's 80, more or less. I'm not being scientific. I'm just, you know.
In the winter.
Right. In the winter, you could expect 72, 75, you know, something like that. And now it's more like 75, 80.
The tourist industry, I wouldn't imagine under these conditions that there's still a thriving tourist industry. Am I mistaken?
Well, let me tell you, about half of the hotels, the larger hotels, closed down and used the opportunity to remodel. And the others stayed open, and most of them are coming back online. The Ritz-Carlton hasn't come back yet. So there are some that are still remodeling. But I think that there's a consensus here that the tourism is going to be Puerto Rico's engine for sustainable economic growth, I guess. And so there's a lot of help by the government in the tourism agency administration here. There's a lot of help for the hotels themselves in trying to help them get their doors open. There's a lot of money flowing in from investors from the outside that are looking at these properties that are really pretty properties. I mean, we have some really amazing real estate, and they're coming in and they're buying it at really good prices. So I think that the tourism will rebound. It took a big hit because people are very afraid. But you know, I don't know if it's disaster tourism, but there were people that after Maria and because I also have friends that do Airbnb, and they kept saying, no, we're still getting calls, and we're telling them, look, there's no electricity, we just have a generator, and they said, don't worry about it, we're going. And they came. So, you know, Puerto Rico has a little bit of everything for everybody, I guess.
Do you have any idea what accounts for that?
Some of the people just wanted to get away from winter last winter. Some people were here because a lot of people came in to help, a lot. And they couldn't find any hotels because the FEMA people, you know, the federal people had taken every single available room, given the fact that most, you know, that half of the hotels were closed. So, you know, that's one of the things that the storm did is it laid bare, you know, everybody's little, I want to say foibles, but it's not a foible. It's just a lack I don't want to say sustainability or resilience. I, you know, they were not prepared for this kind of catastrophe. They weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And it just laid
and
bare.
And how hard is it to adapt at this point? I mean, people are finally getting the message. But it's hard to adapt because the resource has left because of the economic situation.
The problem is that this is the new normal. We cannot accept I don't know which government official said it, but an economist recently said that the newest arrangement with the fiscal board will put us into the next 40 years of paying down a debt we can't pay, of paying it down with money we don't have. So we're building in 20 to 40 years of really hard economic conditions.
And then that's not forgetting that although Puerto Rico was subject to some of these early waves of impact of climate change, that's not the end of the story. And
no.
That's going to be continuing, and you're still
right.
In a vulnerable position.
Every day that passes, every month, every year that passes, we're in an even more vulnerable position. And we can't fight it. I mean, we can't really expect government, you know, either the federal government or the local government to have the resources to do what needs to be done, which is put money out into the economy so that we have a little wiggle room, a little economic wiggle room.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that it's kind of a constant conversation right now among the people I know who are not climate deniers, aware of the whole problem, is that, you know, we kind of need to think and plan together to face these, you know, outscale crises that have been produced by the overriding infrastructures of
mm-hmm.
our society. And at the same time, we're very accustomed to thinking on an individual basis, you know, what should I do? How should I survive? You know, some high net worth people are planning to go to a different planet. You know, commenting on that, you know, what is your sense? I mean, do you ever secretly, you know, in the middle of the night think, I'm not going to be able to take this? At what point maybe am I getting out of here? What about my family? You know, will there be a way of helping them escape? I mean, do you ever think that, or do you kind of feel this is my place, or anywhere in between? Like, what do you, how do you grapple?
Well, to tell you the truth, I have that conversation with myself all the time. And the problem is, you know, that one gets overwhelmed periodically by the horribleness of everything and the lack of real hope for any relief anytime soon. So you become inured to the fact that you are, you know, you're getting older every day. B, things are still getting worse and nobody's doing anything about them. And C, you know, I tried being depressed and it didn't work for me. You know, I have to keep going. I have to keep doing whatever it is I can, because the alternative is not something I want to, you know, even consider doing for a long time. But the only sustainable thing that I can think of doing is working as hard as I can to get as much of the people of Puerto Rico on the same page so that we can move. We've got to stop relying on our government and the federal government and rely on ourselves and just get ourselves up with our bootstraps, whatever the saying is, and do it ourselves, because we cannot expect help from anybody else. I'm sorry, there's a noisy car outside.
Wow. So basically, you're not thinking, how can I save my own skin? You're thinking, you know, I'm going to spend every day helping people do whatever we can, because this is my people, this is my country, and it's not, there's no shield against the sun or other intervention that is going to...
Listen, I've had 10 years of living in a recession, and I've gotten used to not having very much. In fact, I'm very grateful because this going through this in the last 10 years mm-hmm. has taught me how little I really need to survive mm-hmm. and be happy and be able to evolve. You know, mm-hmm. before 2009, I thought that I really needed a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, nice car, a great job, you know, all the trappings. And now I have almost nothing, and I don't care. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, once you don't have that kind of responsibility, it allows you to do all the other things that are important.
Mm-hmm. And what are the things that are important, as you would define them?
Well, I recently started working at Zero Waste. That's important to me, because it's going to mean that I'm going to have to tackle the problem of waste management in Puerto Rico and engage with a public that I'm dying to talk to because they're so creative and they're so involved and they so know that it's necessary, you know, what we are trying to do, and that it's an important part of being sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important, you know, talking to people and getting, you know, as many people as possible on board, because it still amazes me how many people are still shielded from the worst aspects of all of these economic and climatic catastrophes, because they have enough money to still be able to live in very comfortable homes with very comfortable incomes, you know. And they could be there. Most of the ones I know are very good people, but they live in a very different world than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I've got to find a way to get everybody on the same page, and that's my mission.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, are the comfortable people you describe in Puerto Rico, or are there people elsewhere from your time in the States, or, you know,
I mean, I know, both. But the thing is, in Puerto Rico, we had a layer, just like in the States, a layer of a small but wonderful group of people that in my grandfather's time had started their own business, and they had gotten very wealthy doing that, and wonderful for them. Then there was a very thick middle class of people that had good enough jobs that paid enough for their children to go to school and university, and they didn't, you know, they never quite were able to get, you know, a leg up into the real rich class, but they were enough to live well. And then in Puerto Rico, there's at least 20% of the people that live in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a difference between poverty here and poverty in the United States. Here, anybody that lives in the country has can grow plantains and mangoes and fruits. They have chickens, maybe a cow, lots of goats, pigs, and they don't starve. I mean, they don't have medical, they don't have education, but they are living. But that, and you know, so that mentality is very much part of our upbringing. We are people that survive against all odds, but we feel very the difficulty of not having enough to A, have a good education, or B, have enough medical care, and that those two things are something that should be for everybody, not just for the few that are very rich or have a good income.
Mhm. Mhm. Well, this is really you know, these are really great and important lessons. You know, as we're coming down to, you know, the last 10 or 12 minutes of our show, let me just ask you, having been in the States, having been among other people who are into, you know, like concerned about the environment, thinking about sustainability, you know, just average American people or, you know, people in an urban environment from different places that you've encountered. Is Puerto Rico, how well is, you know, with a wake-up call of what you've been through and what you've experienced and what's going on, how well prepared or where or capable of handling this are the Americans that you left behind to some extent when you moved back to Puerto Rico?
That's a good question. Here in Puerto Rico, because we are used to having hurricanes and because we are used to having economic hardship, we were prepared and we are aware. There's a lot of places in the states that, for basically the same reasons, for globalization, for the Internet of Things, for all the modern technologies that are making our lives so much easier and comfortable, that in fact bring with them wealth concentration and the loss of jobs, because, for example, robots are now taking the place of many people in some places. In the name of efficiency, whole towns have lost their middle-class jobs because the companies that afforded them went to China, for example, or they decided to go to Mexico or any place where they could lay people off that were very expensive to pay salaries and Social Security, well, they don't, you know what I mean, benefits, and just put robots in. So this mindset of efficiency in the United States has hollowed out many cities. I mean, Detroit, for Christmas sakes. And every single state, I think, has a city that has been brought down for all these amazing global forces, this tectonic shift in the economy, you know? I think that the Internet is bringing not just all this knowledge so that it's at everybody's fingertips that has a smartphone or a laptop or a tablet, but it's also making people lose jobs. And if you are of a certain age, I'm over 55 myself, all of a sudden it's very hard for some people to get back into this new economy because everything about it is different. And everything that we're used to is old-fashioned and not really needed. And how do you overcome that? You know, you have to look up and say, okay, well, what's going on? Oh, I have to become an entrepreneur because nobody else is going to give me a job. So I have to think about what people need, and of those needs, which ones I can fill, and work very hard to do so. Because even though with the internet and it's global and everything like that, whatever job you have is usually going to be local. I mean, I've got a couple of friends from Colombia that have gotten great at doing consulting jobs in Abu Dhabi and Prague and Paris and all these wonderful places. They go, they stay 2 or 3 months, and then they come back. I can't do that. A lot of people won't be able to do that. They're very lucky. They're very specialized. They get to do it. But it's not a solution for the great majority of people. And, you know, here in Puerto Rico, what people have done is that they have become inured. They just accept that that's the way it is and accept that they're going to have to live in penury, basically, unless they can do a couple of jobs here or there that they get paid under the table with, because nobody's going to hire them and they don't have the wherewithal to really become entrepreneurs, unless they start, you know, cooking or a catering business or, you know, stuff like that. So I think that the lesson for the Americans is they can see that this is happening, and it's gonna, you know, this movie is gonna come to a play to a theater near you soon.
Yeah. There it is. Do you hold, like, you know, what percentage of hope will you hold for let's just kind of talk about it in three different areas. One would be people individually have a wake-up call, realize they care and feel connected to others and change their ways accordingly. Is that a likely scenario? Is it a likely scenario that people become more involved in social and political action and can bring about changes in a timely manner through government or the forces and, you know, the level of activism needed going to make that really tough? And then third choice, that something comes in, you know, like regenerative agriculture or some other solution or combination of solutions that kind of helps buy more time on the climate front to then, I realize I'm giving you a crystal ball here, so, you know, do what you will with it. But if you were, you know, a betting person, you know, where do you see the best opportunity or locus lying?
Mm-hmm. To tell you the truth, I see opportunities in all three of those levels. In the individual mm-hmm. level, both climate change and economic upheaval are demanding that we stop resting on our laurels and start fixing our lives individually. How can I and my family, how can I help my family, you know, survive this? Is it getting a mm-hmm. job? Is it becoming an entrepreneur? Whatever it is, that's what I'll do. Second, mm-hmm. it's also causing us to be much, much more aware of the things that are happening in politics, because not only is government really the richest member of all of us, because we all put our little money into them. They're the ones that have got all the money, even more than the mm-hmm. rich, very rich people. And not only do they have the money, both parties have realized, oh, they're the one, you know, we've got to start changing minds at the political level in order to do what we want. And unfortunately, that has brought us to the amazing politics, I don't even know how to say the word, the chasm that we have between right and left in the United, in the U.S. and actually here mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. and the rise of the nationalist parties, not just in the U.S., but in Poland and in Brazil and Hungary and, you know, there's a backlash. Society is scared of what's going to happen. And when parts of society get scared, they want a strong man to come in and beat everything back and make everything good and, you know, make them feel good again. And that's what's happening. And the third thing is things like, we already have the answers. Regenerative agriculture is so important. We have to start thinking that the only thing we really have to do is start living like my grandparents or some people's great-grandparents used to live. You know? Yes, mm-hmm. the industrialization had already begun by, say, the late 1800s, but it wasn't as entrenched as it is now. And yet, all four of my grandparents had wonderful childhoods and wonderful lives. Okay, so if we just think, well, you know, we won't have everything we have now, but we'll still have a wonderful life. And that's mm-hmm. worth it, because we'll not only save ourselves, but our children and our children's children and the planet. We've already killed off 90% of the apex predators in the sea and 60% of the mammals. Let's save the rest, you know, and we have to, at the same time, think about being socially just. Because if not, all those people that are killing rhinos for their horns, it's because they don't have any other job and no other way of getting money to feed their families. Now, granted, you know, the whole drug thing is another business, and that's another conversation. So not all bad people with guns are you know, killing rhinos or selling drugs. But I truly believe that people get into illegal stuff because they want, well, some of them need the money and some of them are just greedy. I'll give you that. But we already have all the science that we need to live sustainably and happily. Mm-hmm. It won't be easy, because believe me, I thought that I was going to do it. And I can tell you right now, I would have never gotten to this level of simplicity where I am right now unless I hadn't gone through that storm, and that storm had made me go through it. So it's not an easy process. And yet, every single day, I see young people that are living at my level of simplicity and loving it, and they didn't even have to go. I mean, they leapfrogged over all the greediness and all the, oh, I've got to have this, and you know, all that kind of consumerist mindset, and are just living simply. Mm-hmm. So there is hope. I have hope.
Mm-hmm. Great. Wow, this is such a fantastic conversation. I'm so glad that you're able to join us. I think it's, on my Facebook page and in my communities, the two communities where I'm active, we're having these kind of conversations, and your perspective is just so incredibly valuable. It's not the result of, long-standing ideas that, haven't been put to the test or proven. You've been through, I don't want to say the fire, but the water. You've been through the water, and we've spoken several years back before this this transpired, and so it's really wonderful to touch base again and hear all about what you've been experiencing. And thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you for calling. It was I love talking to you. You're such a wonderful listener and such insight into our conversations. Couldn't appreciate it more. Thank you.
And, good luck and blessings to you and your family and your community and Puerto Rico in this time. We'll continue to keep in touch and hope that everything evolves. Thank you for sharing where you are. It's a cautionary for us, and I think we really, really need to deeply listen and take it to heart and get out of our little debates with which we evade these realities. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking today with Monica Perez Navarez and here on Connect the Dots. Thank you to Monica, and thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of the show. I guess it's like, wow, in another 2 weeks, we're going to be in our ninth year. So that's real super exciting of the broadcast. Yes. And hope everyone has a great holiday season, because this is the holiday week, and we're one of the holiday weeks that people will be celebrating. And we're also coming into the solstice, time to contemplate, set your resolutions, see where you want to be, and visualize ways to really get there. So be well, everyone. Happy holidays. And we'll be back with another edition of Connect the Dots next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Heads up, keep marching forward with all our relations.
And there was night, and there was dark, and there was light. There was night, but there was.